Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. The original comprehensive case files of the East Area rapist who became known as the original Night Stalker. A serial rapist turned serial murderer, he held California in a grip of fear for far too long. Larry Crompton tells us of the attacks that began in Northern California in 1976 that continued on until 1986 that we know of. Prior to Sacramento attacks, there was a serial prowler called the Visalia Ransacker with over 125 break-in prowlings under his belt. Detective Crompton had a feeling all of the attacks were connected and tried to tell jurisdictions across the state. Retired from Contra Costa County Department, Larry has never quit searching for this serial predator. Now at long last, Joseph James D'Angelo is the face of the man behind the mask. Presumed innocent until proven guilty, the case appears to have been solved by a 100% DNA match. His name had become the Golden State Killer. Now what we look for are answers. Hopefully, there are not more victims of this serial predator. This book, originally released on paperback in 2010, was the first book out on a case that no one was talking about. Retired Lieutenant Crompton was compelled to write the story so we would not forget. Justice is on the way at last. The book that we're featuring this evening is Sudden Terror, the true story of California's most infamous serial predator, Golden State Killer, Original Night Stalker, a.k.a. East Area Rapist, with my special guest, author and retired Lieutenant Larry Crompton. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Larry Crompton.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate this.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate this, and this is going to be a real treat for the audience. Congratulations, by the way, on this incredible event for law enforcement and in terms of America, a huge moment in history, never let alone true crime history. Congratulations on your involvement, your persistence, your dedication to this case. Congratulations on this arrest.
Well, thank you. It took a long time to get there, but when it did, it found closure for a lot of victims and their families, and that's what it was all about.
Yeah, it's amazing. We use that word. So many people use that word closure, but I think this is, it's inappropriate to be able to use that word, and I think even more closure will come as this person, D'Angelo, goes to trial eventually, soon, or I say eventually. April 24, 2018, as you say, 42 years later, Joseph James D'Angelo, 72 years old, was arrested. Where were you? How did you get notified? And maybe just for background, did you know before this, but on the day, April 24, 2018, how did you get the news? Who gave you the news? And tell us your reaction.
Well, what happened about 9 o'clock that night, I was contacted by Richard Shelby. And right. Richard was on the task force in Sacramento and said that there was a rumor that that he was arrested and was in jail and wanted to know if I had heard about it. And I said, no, I hadn't, but I will check. And I called Larry Poole, the sergeant that I had met with the Orange County task force, and right. asked him if he had heard. And he said, no, I hadn't, but he said, let me check. So he called me back about 15 minutes later and said, it is true. He was arrested tonight, and he is in custody, and yes. and I couldn't sleep that night. I couldn't close my eyes. It was just, it was so awesome that after all these years that it happened.
Yeah. Like you say, you didn't sleep that night. The next day, you were obviously anxious and excited and definitely curious to the details. What did you find out in the next day, in the following days? What did you find out about this D'Angelo and his arrest? What did you find out?
Well, it took a while for me to find out. Obviously, I was retired and was still in contact with some of them. But the night that I found out about it, I contacted Jane Carson. She was the fifth victim in Sacramento, and told her that he had been arrested, and she was in tears. So I had to find out as much as I could. But I was in contact with Sergeant Ken Clark in Sacramento, and he told me that they had been watching him for a week, and the DNA, the familial DNA, had connected several, and they narrowed it down to two, and said that then they narrowed it down to one, and that one obviously was Joseph. And they said they followed him for a week, and they watched him, and then they got some more DNA off of him, and that matched up even more. And then they videotaped him, and then they waited for him until he come out of the house, and then they arrested him as he come out. And like I said, at that time, that was the best way to do it, because what he wanted to do was to go back in the house and obviously get a gun. When I was working the case, I had talked to psychiatrists and other people that were dealing with rapists, and what they told me was that if you come across him before he commits a crime, you're never going to put it together. He is going to be so good that you'll never know. If you come across him after he commits a crime, he will kill you or he will kill himself, but he won't be taken. Mm-hmm. And I lived with that thought all those years. And then when I saw how they did it and the way they did it, I thought, yeah, psychiatrists were right on course. They knew what he was. So it was exciting to know how they did it. And then I saw him went saw him when he went into court the first time, and in the wheelchair. And then once he found out what they knew about him, things have changed. And I still don't know when he's going to ever say anything. And hopefully we'll learn from him what we need to be looking for when we come across somebody like him.
Mm-hmm. What was the... I talked to our mutual friend, Ann Pent, and she has written extensively about this case and her involvement with her aunt and uncle, Lyman and Charlene Smith. And she spoke extensively of the support that she had through this with specifically you, in terms of your empathy and compassion and just understanding about what it would be like and the answers that these people needed to have, even if there is not an answer, but or the reassurances. Other than Jean Carson, and I mentioned Lorianne Ann Penn, a.k.a., how many of the victims did you interact with, and for how long? Tell us a little bit more about that contact with those people and what that was like.
Well, I when I was on television one time, and then I wrote the book, and I was contacted by Jane Carson, and I had a lot of talks with her and stayed with her, and I told her that She was a survivor. And I said, your history and what you went through, you need to put that in a book and get it out. And it's not just for rape victims. It's for victims of any crime. And what she went through and how she dealt with it and what she became was important. So she did. She wrote her book, Frozen in Fear, and it is fantastic. And then I was also able to be in contact with Michelle Cruz. She's a sister of Janelle Cruz, the young lady that was murdered, and Debbie Domingo, the daughter of Sherry Domingo. And we've stayed in contact. And there really are the only victims and families that I've stayed in contact with continually. And others I have dealt with, but not the same way that I have with these. And seeing what they went through and how they dealt with it, and it just made it so that I had to stay with it because I saw what they went through and what they needed.
Over all these years, what could you say to them that would keep them repeatedly calling you? What would and not be critical, as many people would do, understandably, that there hadn't been an arrest? Why not? Tell us, what could you possibly say to these people, and what was the tone of these conversations to be able to keep these people at least hoping?
Well, I would tell them I knew that the investigations were ongoing, and that the ones that were involved at that time were 100% into it, and wanted this closed, and they wanted it closed for the victims and their families. And they went through the same thing I did. For many years, I blamed myself and thought I needed to get this closed. I needed. And then it came to me, it wasn't about me. This is about the victims and their families. So that's what I would talk to them about how they were dealing with it and how strong they were, and that those that were involved and were working on it were doing everything they could, and that I just couldn't give it up, and told them that I had to stay with it, and anything that I could do for them, I would, and any time I heard anything, I made sure that it was given to Sacramento or to Larry Poole down in Orange County to follow up on. And then I got involved with three civilians down in Sacramento that were also involved in the cases, and they were involved because they were in the area when he was hitting, and then they saw me on TV and saw my book and got it. So I was in contact with them, and I knew that they had such a close contact with Sacramento Sheriff's Office, with the detectives there. So anything that I had, I made sure that I got to them, and they could work on it and get information back to me. And those three kept the case going and would not give up on it. And Melanie Barbeau and Kay Gilbraith, Robert Neville, they just were so involved in this that they were the ones that kept the case going. They just wouldn't let it go, and they made sure that Sacramento was on top of everything that they come up with. So what I've said all along, law enforcement is not going to be solving crimes by themselves. They need the civilians to be involved, and that's what happened here. And it was because of that it was finally solved. And have to give credit to those people that stayed with it. And Richard Shelby, the retired detective from Sacramento, couldn't give up on it. He put his book out, and Paul Holes, criminalist from Sacramento, or from Contra Costa, he stayed with it. And Larry Poole couldn't give up on it. Ken Clark, Paul Belli from Sacramento, they stayed with it. So it was that that finally solved this case.
They could have just looked at your book that you published in 2010, but that's not the extent of your input in this case and with those people like Poole and Paul Holes that you mentioned from the FBI in Contra Costa County. Tell us more about this relationship with Paul Holes and at least when he came on board and his interest in this case and your at least assistance in helping him understand this case.
Well, what happened was Jim Bevins was the detective in Sacramento that I worked with very close. He
right.
came down to our county and told us about the East Area Rapist. And at that time, there had been 37 attacks, and we knew nothing about it. And so I started working with Jim Bevins. And then Jim called me one time, and he said that he heard of a double homicide down in Santa Barbara, and said that he called Santa Barbara, and they said, "Don't know what you're talking about." And so he ran it by me, so I called Santa Barbara, and I got the same thing back, that no, we don't know what you're talking about. We have nothing like that. So it just so happened that the sheriff sent me down to a class down in San Diego at the university, and there happened to be a Santa Barbara officer in the class, and I got talking to him, and he said, "Oh, yeah, we did. We had a double homicide," and he said, "Robert Offerman and Deborah Manning," and he said, "And just before that, we had an attempted rape where the people got away," and I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah," and I said, "Well, gosh, we knew nothing about that." So I got those reports, and Jim Bevins and I went over them, and we, in our minds, yes, their murderer, their attempted rapist, was our rapist. But nobody would believe us, and nobody wanted to get involved. His department, my department, said, "No, he's left our area. He's no longer ours, and no, it's not the same person." So what happened was in... Paul Holes called me and said that he heard that I had been on the East Area Rapist Task Force. And he said, "I'm a DNA expert here at the lab." And he said, "If you can give me some names, I'll do the DNA." Because back then we didn't have DNA when all this was going on.
No.
And we only knew that it was the same person committing the rapes because of the way that he did it. And there was no doubt in our minds that. But I gave him three names, and he called me back a while later and said, "Yeah, I joined two of them." And then he called me back another month later and said, "Yeah, all three of them have the same DNA. So I said, "Okay, Paul, I know that down in Southern California, I know of five homicides. And I said, I can't get any cooperation, but if you can get a criminalist down there that will work with you, I know they have evidence, and I know that their murderer is our rapist." And I said, "If you can get them to cooperate with you, I know it's there." So he called me back about 7 months later, and he said, "No, they didn't have five homicides. Said they had 10, and we just joined six of them." So that was exciting, and he said that Orange County wanted me to fly down there and talk to them. So I contacted Orange County, and the sheriff wanted me to come down. And I told him, I said, "I have all the reports of Northern California attacks." And I said, "If you want, you can send your detective up here. I have the contact up here. We can go to the sheriff's department and get copies of them." And he said, "No, we want you down here." He said, "We'll pay to have you and all the reports." So I flew down there with them and met with their task force. and stayed there for a couple of weeks going over everything. And that opened up the investigation because they didn't know who they were looking for or what type of a person they were looking for. But after looking at the reports from Northern California, it gave them a better idea. And I didn't know at the time, but they had already done DNA on some of theirs down there prior to that. And so that part was already there. And it was just a matter of connecting it and then trying to find out who that would connect to. But that got the investigation going and opened it up north and south, and that really helped.
After this, you also employ every other strategy to be able to move this investigation forward. And like you say, with the FBI and with that connection and the DNA connection, it becomes much more cohesive and much more viable investigation for everyone. When you were doing other things like A&E reached out to you, Bill Curtis and Cold Case Files, and then later some other television programs. And then, so tell us a little bit about that outreach and what the purpose of that was and why you were wanted to be involved with that. And before we talk about other things like reaching out to Kim Rosmo, geographical profiler.
Yeah, well, it was, with me, I couldn't get it out of my mind. I had to stay with it. And I was contacted by several television programs and radio and newspaper. As a matter of fact, Michelle McNamara contacted me, and she did a thing for a magazine on me. Right. And so that opened it up so that I was contacted by many people and really got involved in it that way. And I just wanted it to keep on going and couldn't let it die. And it was just one of those things that stayed in my mind. And like I said, I kept thinking that I was supposed to close that case. I was supposed to catch him, and I failed, and I failed. And then it finally dawned on me that it wasn't about me. It was about the victims and their families. So anything and everything that I could do, I stayed with it. And I was very, very fortunate to be able to work with Larry Poole and Ken Clark and Paul Belli. And with those three working the case at the same time, I knew that there was a good chance that it would eventually be solved.
You talk about, I mentioned Ken Rosmo, or Kim Rosmo, pardon me. You have in the book, which is rereading it again after interviewing you in 2012, that it's very interesting what, through his geographical profiling, using zip codes and that information into a program and trying to pinpoint where the perpetrator was residing during those attacks. It was interesting to see what he said. In light of D'Angelo's arrest, your idea that, didn't you believe he's still probably resided in Sacramento? Is it interesting to see what Kim Rosmo had deduced so long ago in 2003?
Oh, yes. I was contacted by Mike Weymouth, who was a detective with Contra Costa, and he and I had worked together. And he was in patrol when I was on the task force. And Mike is the one that contacted me and told me about Kim Rosmo and said that he was an excellent person to deal with this. And Kim did put a lot of time into it and felt the areas where he would be. And in all those years, I felt that he was still in Sacramento. I couldn't get it out of my mind that he was in Sacramento, but couldn't come up with any any proof or anything else, but with what Kim decided and what he showed and what he gave me, everything just fit. And thought that because of that, we'd be able to find out something, but because of the way that some things go, we couldn't get names or anything else from different phone calls and things like that. But it still helped, and it narrowed it down to areas. And he felt the same way I did, that that D'Angelo, even though we didn't know who D'Angelo was, that he was in Sacramento. And worked out that way.
You write in the book, well before you know who is going to be the perpetrator, that the police departments are praying that and hoping that it's not a member of law enforcement that's the perpetrator in this. You're a member of law enforcement, so, I mean, in light of this, this is a victory. This is an incredible victory. How surprising was it for you? I mean, in the book you talk about that it looks like you've narrowed it down and he has military training, and you give the evidence for that, and that's been discussed. But how surprised were you that he was a police officer? And just what was your response when you found that out? What'd you think?
Well, to be honest with you, it didn't affect me that much. In all those years, I felt that because of the way that he acted and because of his knowledge about guns, he had to have some kind of a background. And I felt that he was either in the military or family was, or possibly family that was in law enforcement. And I just felt that the knowledge that he had and the way that he talked about the weapons and the fact that he had different weapons, he had to have some kind of a background. And I was in internal affairs for several years. And unfortunately, I was involved in several deputies being fired for misconduct or other things. So you know that no matter what the profession is, there's a chance that they're bad ones. It doesn't matter whether it's teachers or ministers. It doesn't sure. matter. It can happen anywheres. And the fact that it happened to be somebody that had been in law enforcement, even though it was for a short time, the only thing that I got out of it and the ones that I talked to got out of it was they were just happy that he was caught. And the fact that he was law enforcement did not affect us that way. We were just glad that he was caught.
Oh, no, I didn't mean it in that way. What I meant was when you've racked your brain to say, who is this? And other people have done criminal profiles to say who this person might be. Who is he likely to be? When you realize it's, okay, a 72-year-old person, but you realize he was a police officer briefly, does that contribute to any of the, aha, how he got away with it, how he's such an effective rapist and killer for so long?
No, to me it was different. It was because he was in law enforcement, why wasn't it brought to somebody's attention? And the fact that where he was when it was happening, and one of the reasons I wrote the book was that I was hoping somebody would read it and say, I know somebody that had been in those areas at that time. And what we find out now, Joseph D'Angelo was in those areas at that time, and it was very obvious that he was in those areas. And as law enforcement, I think that he probably, in his patrol car, did prowl areas to know where he was going to go, but nobody ever seemed to have even noticed a patrol car. And in most people's minds, when they see a patrol car and it goes by, it doesn't stay in their mind. So he had every opportunity to do what he did. And when I learned about the rapes that that happened in Sacramento and went through the reports, and I thought, there's no way that somebody could have started out with that kind of a plan. He had to have something prior to that. And I thought maybe he had been arrested for rape and went to prison and got a better system to work on. So I got all parolees from a six-month period prior to the first Sacramento attack, and I had between 7,000 and 9,000 altogether. And my partners and I would go up to Sacramento and go through all the parolees and eliminate them for different reasons, that they were in prison during some of the rapes or different sizes and stuff like that. And we narrowed it down to about 45. And those 45, I couldn't contact, never found. Their parole officers didn't know where they were. And a couple of them really looked good. And that was one thing that when D'Angelo was arrested, that was one thing that unfortunately was in my mind. I'm glad he wasn't one of my parolees, because if he was, then I would have missed it. And that's not the way that I should have looked at it. Again, I was thinking of me and I fouled up. I didn't. And had to get it in my mind that that's not what it was about. It was, we eliminated thousands of names over the years. Some of them really look good. But some of them we had to work on, and worked on them for months before we could eliminate them. And but those are things that you do, and it just stays with you. And that's what, like I said, for years, I would wake up in the middle of the night. What did I miss? What did I do wrong? And just comes to you finally that no, it finally did happen, and it happened for the right reason. It happened so that the victims and their families could finally find closure. And yes, it probably will be another year or more before he goes to court, and so it's going to take a lot. But I really would like to know what was in his head, and what did we miss, and what could we have done better. And I don't know if he'd tell us or not, but I'd like to be one of the ones talking to him. But unfortunately, I'm retired, so that won't happen. But that's what it's all about.
Absolutely. We're going to just use this as an opportunity, Larry, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, and we're going to talk more about the origins of Sudden Terror and all of the things in the investigation and what you put in Sudden Terror and why. Tonight's episode is brought to you by Ring. Ring's mission is to make neighborhoods safer. You might already know about their smart video doorbells and cameras that protect millions of people everywhere. Ring helps you stay connected to your home anywhere in the world. So if there's a package delivery or a surprise visitor, you'll get an alert and be able to see, hear, and speak to them, all from your phone. That's thanks to the HD video and two-way audio features on Ring devices. We received our Spotlight Cam battery, a battery-powered security camera with LED spotlights and siren, and I mean a siren, a motion-activated security light with an HD camera and automated recording and two-way talk. And it was bright enough, I swear, to light up our entire backyard, and we got a big backyard. 270 degrees of motion detection. Super easy to follow instructions. I installed it easily and fairly quickly. Impressive HD picture. Like I say, lit up the whole backyard. When we tested it, my wife and I now feel very, very secure with our Ring Spotlight Cam. As a listener, you have a special offer on a Ring Starter Kit available right now. With a video doorbell and motion-activated floodlight cam, the Starter Kit has everything you need to start building a ring of security around your home. Just go to ring.com/murder. That's ring.com/murder. We talked about, Larry, about all of the things that you were doing, the networking that you were doing, the people that recognized and realized that you were an asset, and a valuable asset in moving this investigation to the next level to try to find closure for the victims. As you said, you realized that when you got caught up in that it was about you at all, then you realized that it really was about the victims and closure for them. When you wrote this book in 2010, it was, again, after you were retired, what was the goal of the book? What was the purpose of the book at that time?
Well, I started writing the book while I was still working, but I couldn't put the book together because, like I said, nobody would believe me that the murders and the rapes were connected. So I just didn't feel like I wanted the book out there at that time. And then once I found out about the murders and was able to join that and then was able to get some of the reports, then I put the book together. And I only wrote that book for that one reason, to get it out there so that somebody would come up with a name. They would see where these acts were taking place and how violent they were. And during the time that this was going on, Joseph DeAngelo was not the most active rapist in California. He was the most violent. And in every one of his attacks, the people, the victims knew that they were going to die. In their mind, he was going to kill them. And he made sure that they knew that on every one of those attacks. It wasn't until the 16th attack that there was a man in the house. After the 15th attack, the newspaper came out and said that there had never been a man in the house. So obviously, he read the newspaper. And the next one, there was a man in the house. And then he started putting dishes on the man's back and telling them, if I hear these rattle, I'll kill your wife, I'll kill you, I'll cut off the ears of your child, bring them to you. That type of thing. His whole thing, and I went and met with a doctor at the Vacaville Medical Center, and I gave her some reports, and she worked with the rapists that were in custody, and asked her to go over the reports, and then I went back a week later to talk to her, and she said, yeah, I've met with my rapist. You had better catch him. He wants to kill, and he's going to kill. And I asked her, I said, well, why hasn't he? I didn't tell her about the two that were murdered in Sacramento. And I just asked her, why hasn't she? And she said he hasn't found the justification yet. Once he finds the justification, he's going to kill. And she said, my rapist in here said that he's given them a bad name. And I said, given them a bad name? And she said, well, you got to understand, they don't think that they hurt anybody. They're doing it for sex. This person is not doing it for sex. He's doing it for the terror that he can put in their minds, and he's doing it because he wants to kill them. And what we found out was, after the last attack in my area, the people got away. The reason they got away is because all these attacks now were in the newspaper, so they knew what was going to happen. And they worked out a plan that if they were attacked, there was an escape route, and if they could get that escape route, then they'd get away. Well, very, very fortunate the way that it happened that time. The man woke up when the rapist was just putting his ski mask over his face, so he didn't have a gun in his hand. And the man woke up yelling and shouting at him, screaming at him, and it got the rapist confused. It gave the wife an opportunity to hit the escape route and to get away. And once the husband realized that she was free, then he did the same thing, and then the rapist got away. Then when he hit down in Santa Barbara the first time down there, again, the people got away. That was his justification. No one was going to get away again. And that's when he started murdering each and every one of them. And going through the reports, you could tell that sex was not his number one priority. It was the terror that he put in their minds. And just about all of the women said that he never had a full erection. They could hear him lubricating himself, all that. So that's not what it was. The doctor at the Vacaville Medical Center, she was right. Once he found that justification, that was it. No one was going to get away from him again.
You talk about all along in this book that you have to reassure people because, bizarrely, the man feels guilty that he didn't do more. When he's told, he's tied up, he's restrained, he's got dishes on his back, he's been threatened, and yet still, you have to talk to these people. You came up fairly quickly I didn't see any background that would make you be able to do this, but you came up with the idea that you better tell them something. What did you tell these husbands after these attacks? What did you tell these people?
In talking to them, I tell them, I know that in your mind, your number one priority was to save your wife or your girlfriend. But if you had done something, he would have killed you. The rape, yes, it's bad. It is very bad, and it's going to be hard to live with. But you're still living. And if you had fought him, there's a very, very good opportunity for him to do what he wanted to do, and that was to kill. So I would talk to him and tell him, you've got to deal with it, knowing that you did everything you could right. And I know it was difficult for many of them. Many of them ended up in divorce, because I couldn't deal with the fact that they did not take care of their wife. And I tried to get that in their mind that you did the right thing by dealing with it the way that you did. And now just try and work together and deal with it that way. And I know it was very hard, but I saw in talking to them, I knew what was in their mind, and I knew the fear that was there, and I knew that their number one priority in their mind was to save their loved one. And in most cases, in their mind, they didn't do it. And it was hard to get them to understand that. And it would be hard for me to understand it if it had happened to me. So very, very difficult. But I spent as much time as I could with them, talking to them. And like I said, when I finally met with Jane Carson and got to go through her life and what she went through and how she dealt with it, and then I got it into my mind that, yes, it can happen. They can get through it. And her book is one that, like I said, victims need to read and know that they can survive and can deal with things.
You also, maybe we can talk about this now, that we talked about Ann Penn, a.k.a. or Lori Ann. Her relatives, Charlene and Lyman Smith, she has a different relationship with you in terms of she's not your average victim because of her being an author and a journalist, and having a little bit different approach to how she would exist as a survivor, her survival techniques. Tell us just a little bit about your interaction with her.
Well, when I first met up with Lori and went through what was on her mind, and that with Lyman being murdered the way that he was, and Charlene, and for her to be part of that family and know what was going through her mind, and she started telling me what she was doing, and she was writing a book and about family and what families go through and what they do. And I found that she was so involved in trying to get this out for people to look at, to let them know what a family does go through and how important it is to deal with it, and how important it was to find closure. And very, very, very dedicated young lady. And it was good in reading her book to find out what went through the minds of those family members like that. And it proves to all of us in law enforcement how important it is to solve these crimes and get that final closure.
In your original book, you did something, so in true crime at least, it's unusual and untypical. Why is part of your book, I mean, you have all the descriptions and you got the cooperation I was going to mention too. You got all the cooperation with these people when it was time to put out this book. This is graphic stuff that has to be released. So you had that trust from those family members to be able to put that in the book and tell them why you needed, they needed, everyone needed to have that in the book to move this forward, to maybe jar someone's mind to, again, details that could help. You. This is all from the commitment from everyone involved. You, as one of the earliest people pushing this investigation forward. Why is some of the book fictionalized? Tell us what the purpose is of some of the book fictionalized and what parts are.
Well, because I wasn't involved in the first 37 attacks, knew nothing about those attacks, I got the reports, but I had never talked to those detectives, never talked to any of those victims. So I didn't want to use the detectives' names, and I would not use the victims' names except in the homicides, because that is out there. But in the rape, the victims' names are not out there. So there's no way I would do that. And the only thing that I put in there was that I got from the reports themselves, the initial reports that were written, and also in talking to Sergeant Jim Bevins with Sacramento, and that's where I got the information from. And once it was out there, and a lot of the things that I put in the book also was articles from the newspapers when they finally did start putting it into the newspaper. The first several attacks, they didn't want it out there to let the rapists know that they were looking for them. So they didn't want it in the news. And then once it got in the news, then obviously that increased it. But other than that, the only thing I did differently, I tried to put a little humor in the book to break it up a little bit, and also to show how police officers do work at times, and what they go through and how they deal with it. And what we found out during all this was that very, very few departments did cooperate and did work together. And that was the bad thing back then. What you did yourself stayed there. And when I finally was on the task force and started working, I went down to Berkeley to talk to a detective down there that was working the stinky rapist. And we knew about the stinky rapist, and we knew he was hitting in that area. And while I was talking to him, he told me that San Jose had been hit twice by a rapist. And we knew nothing about that. And I kept talking to him, and I said, well, how come we didn't know about it? And he said, well, you got to understand. He said, with San Jose, if the rape victim does not know who the rapist is, they don't investigate it. It's just put off to the side. And I couldn't believe that any department would work that way, because I had worked several rapes in my career. And prior to doing this, I was involved in them. And I thought, how can any department work that way? It's important for those victims. And but he said, well, they're so busy down there, they just don't have the time. And that's the way that it was. But like I said before, I said D'Angelo was not the most active rapist. He was the most violent. But we had, at that time in California, he had the woolly rapist, the early morning rapist, the pillowcase rapist, Stinky, like I said, the car key rapist, San Diego PD, East San Diego rapist. And some of those were never caught. Some of them were caught and sent to prison. One was arrested, sent to prison, got out, and went back east and was arrested back there for rape. So it's something that you look back on and you think what was going on, and the fact that we weren't cooperating with each other. Like I said, I was very, very, very fortunate to be able to work with Jim Bevins with Sacramento and Larry Poole with Orange County. And we did work together, and we did not keep anything from each other. But that was different than most agencies. And even in my county, when he hit in Walnut Creek, they told me they didn't need my help. The first one that they hit in Walnut Creek was a 17-year-old that was babysitting, and I went and talked to her and found out that she had not babysat there for 2 months, so he could not have known. And so I said, that's not who he was after. He's after somebody else in your neighborhood. And they said, we don't need your help. And a week later, they did hit, and he hit a 13-year-old, and that's the one he was after the first time. So it's that lack of cooperation that really hurt us back then. And I'm hoping that today it's different. And like I said, we knew nothing about the rapes in Sacramento. And even in Davis, which was only a few miles from us, we did not know anything about them, because if you didn't live in the town or get that newspaper, you didn't hear about it. Today, if a dog is bitten back in New York, it's in the paper the next day. So out here. So it's different now, but back then it was very difficult.
You talk about cooperation, and the ultimate cooperation is what led to this arrest and capture and this incredible use of the familial DNA. Did you go through what regular citizens can do, and that innovation? Obviously, when we talked about in the very beginning, you found out you sure didn't get a call from the FBI, you found out. Tell us more about prior to this, the last year, we'll say. It seemed to me, in dealing with Ann Penn, that the FBI was doing, to me, it seemed an unprecedented, in my mind, outreach to the public. It seemed like they were very, very confident as well that there would be an arrest without giving away what they were doing. But everybody still has seen progress with DNA technology. Did you sense a renewed interest that something was afoot? What did you feel in the last year or previous to this, in the last while? Did you see any change? Did you anticipate anything? What was that? Did you see anything, or is it all my mind?
No, I did. When the FBI got involved and put out the reward, and I thought, this is going to open it up. Unfortunately, when the rapes were going on, a lot of times citizens could have called in things and didn't. One heard a window being broken at the neighbor and thought, oh, they're not home, so nobody can get hurt. They came home later that night, and the rapists attacked them. But that's what was going on then. But once the FBI got involved and did have their meetings and did put it out there, I thought, this is going to open it up. And now maybe we can get something. And again, with the FBI, it doesn't matter what county or what state even, they do have that cooperation. And we weren't having that cooperation among departments. So I thought this was going to open it up and going to help. And the big thing was that because Paul Holes stayed with it, because of the DNA, that's what kept it going. And he kept trying to connect. And then when we got into the familial DNA, since this has happened, I've heard of 15 cold cases that have been closed now because of DNA. So we're going in the right direction. My feeling all along, I've said this many times, that when a baby's born, if you put that DNA in the system, it's going to protect that child. If it's a body that's found later, you're going to be able to identify it. And if it's kidnapped or killed or whatever, and it may even help cut back on crime. But if it's out there, if it's in there, like fingerprints, I got fingerprints off a lamp one time and couldn't get it matched anywheres. And then when I got working with Larry Poole, I gave him that fingerprint. He did get it matched, and the person was dead. And he went back and exhumed the body and got the DNA and proved that it was not our rapist. But things like that can work. And if you can do it with fingerprints, DNA is even more important. But too many people think, no, that's a private thing. So may not happen.
I agree with you too about when they did this through, like I mentioned, just what regular citizens would be able to do, a genealogy site like Ancestry.com for reference to say look for relatives for your own family tree, and this is what law enforcement did to be able to arrest D'Angelo and solve these cases. Like you say, another 15 cold cases, and that's incredible. And these are kind of slam dunk, if there is such a thing, kind of trials. It's pretty hard to dispute. It's going to be impossible for him to dispute this at trial with. So it's more slam dunk, would say. In that DNA and that privacy that you mentioned, I agree with you that for the good of, again, law enforcement, really the only thing and the best thing that has happened in the judicial system is the advent of DNA. So the idea that they couldn't go into a private genealogy site to be able to search for that, I think that you, given these kinds of results, privacy has to be, I hate to say that, but I can't be fixed on the idea of privacy always under any circumstances. So I do agree with you. It could be a very, very good tool. Then again, we'd get into the subject of the effectiveness, efficacy of some of these databases. so, and compliance to put material into the database, right? So.
Yes. Well, when I was working the cases, the only thing we had was secretor status, and we knew that D'Angelo was a non-secretor, which meant you couldn't get his blood from it, and that's how we eliminated a lot of people. And in some of them, it took a lot because they would get attorneys saying, "No, you got to stay away from us." And a couple of them I had to work on for a long time, and finally did get them to chew on some gauze, and we eliminated them. But it would have been so much easier if we had known anything about DNA at the time and was able to do that. But there are ways that you work it, and you work on it. And like I said, we eliminated thousands of names, and there were different ways of doing it. And we did what we could, and I'm just so glad now for the victims and their families, and know that hopefully within the next year, they're going to find full closure and see what happens.
What's very interesting, too, is that I think hopefully anyway, that some of the glamour that comes with some of these killers, their status reverts and then they become mythical and glamorous in prison after these convictions. I think it's in everybody's, the way he's been depicted and in the nature of his crimes that, and I think just the, and maybe I won't even mention it just out of respect for the audience, but that just about the description of him and his behavior, crying, and there is nothing, it would seem only the insane would think that this guy was admirable in any way, the kind of person you would contact and the kind of person that would gain some kind of following. Don't you think this is not the candidate for turning this into a sexy criminal post-trial at all?
No. It's like I said with the doctor I dealt with at the Vacaville Medical Center and the rapist there. My feeling is that when he goes to prison, the prisoners will hate him because the rapist that are in prison felt that they didn't hurt anybody. They committed crimes, but they didn't hurt anybody. But this person did, and they're going to hate him. And because of who he is and what they learn about him, many of them in there would like to kill him, and for that reason. And so it's going to be very dangerous for him, and it's going to have to be taken care of that way. But we know that because it's in California, there's no death penalty that's going to work there. So he will be in prison for the rest of his life, and it's going to be a rough time for him in prison.
Mm-hmm. The book Sudden Terror came out in 2010, and this intended purpose was to move this thing forward. Obviously, this book was, the information gained in that was contained in the book helped people like Paul Holes. Paul Holes spoke to you extensively. You were not to depict it like you took him under your wing, but it was essential that Paul Holes speak to you and understand, read this book and understand these cases. It was essential for him to do that, not to give credit where credit was due, but it was essential that he read this and understand these cases and understand what you had to contribute to this case, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And like I said, I was working at the lab when we first found out about this, and that's how he found out about me, one of the people at the lab, when he got involved in the DNA, told him that I was on the task force, and said I would have the names of victims, and if he contacted me, then he could carry it on that way, and that was very, very fortunate. And then when he was able to deal with Southern California, with Orange County, and joined the DNA, and then he stayed with it after that. And that's what finalized this. You had to have those to stay with it. And like I said, even though Larry Poole retired, he couldn't let it go. He had to stay with it, and right to the very end, he was involved. And what people don't understand is that in law enforcement, there's many times that these crimes get into your mind, and you can't let it go. I had one in the crime lab, a little 14-year-old that was kidnapped, raped, and murdered, and I went out and processed the scene, and then I had to go to the morgue and take the photograph of them working on her, and I was up on the ladder with my camera looking down, and Cindy Waxman was her name at the time, and I couldn't deal with it. I told my partner, "You got to take this one. I'll take the next five, but I can't deal with it." And we thought we knew who it was, but they could never prove it. And then after I retired and moved away, I got a subpoena to go to court. They arrested him, and the DNA did work. So it is good. Oh, it's
getting
things
closer
like that
for you, Larry.
Yeah, you can't get it out of your mind, and you stay with it.
Well, I contend that this book, Sudden Terror, is what made these people recognize you. Definitely instilled the fear, as you write, the fear that these people felt, you felt. And from this book, Sudden Terror, it captures that fear, that terror, and that was imparted to each and everyone that read it. All the detectives, all the civilians, all the people around you were influenced by your work. And this contributed, as you did, to the capture of Joseph DeAngelo. So again, congratulations, and congratulations on this book, Sudden Terror, now available on Kindle. So thank you very much, Larry Crompton, for coming on and talking about Sudden Terror, the true story of California's most infamous serial predator, Golden State Killer, ONS, a.k.a. East Area Rapist. Thank you very much, Larry Crompton, for coming on and doing this interview. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Dan. I really appreciate what you're doing.
Thank you very much. I hope to talk to you again real soon. Thank you very much, Larry. You have a great evening.
You too. Thanks.
Good night.